Welcome. You're listening to Ireland Life with myself, David Kinley, a series of programmes entitled New World, Old Ways, where we discuss the history, culture, folklore, superstitions and music of the Manx emigrees to the New World, the USA and in particular the Appalachian Mountains. In today's episode, I speak to Mr. Robert Teer.
Wesleyanism, Methodism, primitive Methodism, liberty, freedom, emancipation, emigration. It's a preloaded subject, this, isn't it?
There's a lot of stuff there.
There's a lot of stuff here, yes, sir. Wesleyanism. We've got Wesleyanism coming in 1758. John Wesley visits in 1777, preaches in Castletown, of course, and in Ramsey, I know of, and so I've heard.
Yeah.
It becomes very attractive to the Manx.
Yeah.
Why?
I think one of the main things is the Church of England was quite unpopular with a lot of people because of the tithes.
Which were excruciatingly expensive.
Yeah. The Lords of Athol really... turned the screws, you know. George Murray was appointed bishop, and one of the things that they were doing was putting a tithe on green crops, which hadn't been done before. And this caused, there were riots in Douglas and Peel, and farms were being attacked, and farms that helped collect the tithes. Mobs were walking out in Patrick and burning down the stores, you know. And time, you know, it was really authoritarian in those days, life generally.
And what comes with that is the prosecution of people who are living in penury and poverty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so you read stories in the newspapers of the one that stands in my mind was the boy in Ramsey who was convicted of stealing rabbit skins and was whipped in the four market towns on consecutive Sundays, you know. And then all the cases of people being they were lucky if they got sent to Australia for stealing a sheep, because the usual sentence was a hanging. You know, so it was desperate.
It was desperate.
Like I say, you know, you don't riot over the price of potatoes unless you're really hungry, you know.
Starving.
Yeah, yeah. So times were tough. Wesleyism was a lot more democratic. And one of the things that there were two things in particular. One was the primitive Methodists had female preachers.
And which is still under conjecture in various religious organizations even today.
Yes, but, you know, they had... I found a book in the library by Anne Neal of Regaby. And it's beautiful handwriting. She was obviously a teacher as well as a primitive Methodist preacher, but also, you know, just a woman on a farm. Mm-hmm. And she was, you know, education was important for people to escape this. Mm-hmm. And we have translations into Manx of things from the Methodist magazine and, you know, the anti-drink message and the kind of we can better ourselves. It was strong and it appealed to people. Well, I think the main thing was the singing, the music, because, you know, the Manx, very musical people, they had this long tradition of self-composed carvels. But the Church of England, until 1820, didn't have hymns. So the Methodists, they had this tradition of singing. So very appealing to the Manx.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah. There's that lovely picture of Mr. Taggart as well up at Kerrykeel Chapel in the latter part of the 1800s with his cello.
Oh, right. Yes.
And those famous words of when they were going to do like a 30-verse hymn. They're going, should we cut it down, Mr. Taggart? Nay, we shall play them all.
I mean, you can imagine too, you know, if the Church of England, if the bishop is imposing, you know, extreme tithes on people and is linked so closely to this really harsh administration, You can imagine why Methodism was appealing.
Indeed, yeah. But of course, we get to the reasons for emigration itself, and it is persecution, religious freedom, poverty. There was such a huge amount of people from Ireland and then the Highland clearances as well in Scotland, and they're going for poverty reasons.
So
I see the Manx go in there, not quite for the liberty, but it comes parcel of their existence there, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. So you have to think, you know, in the Isle of Man, the Dukes of Atholl were harsh. And the keys in those days were self-selecting. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't much democracy here, and there wasn't very much freedom. And Methodism was very liberating for people. So when they got to America, you can imagine quite a lot of them had views on the slavery issue.
Indeed.
Which was, you know, because they arrived in the United States in the first half of the 19th century. And a lot of them went to Cleveland, Ohio. But I've seen also quite a lot were going into Kansas and Missouri, which in those days was in a very almost state of civil war. They called it Bloody Kansas, right? And you have these Manx families, Keynes, Cottiers, Banks, Stevens, Corkills, right in the middle of it.
I see.
Yeah.
And of course, their neighbours at the time, they're not all Wesleyan Methodists. They're from all over the place. We've got Protestants and Catholics, Jewish Orthodox, Baptists. And so they've got to hold their own, basically, in their beliefs.
Yeah, and there's a Philip Crane in New York writing in the 1850s because they kept in touch with the Isle of Man. They wrote letters to the Herald newspaper, and the Herald was the radical newspaper, you know, the libertarian, radical newspaper of the day, liberal. And Philip Crane is writing there, and he's talking about the slavery issue and the racism in America. And I know in one of his letters, he's complaining that these people talk about equality, but they won't sit next to black people in church, you know? And he said, and he's disgusted by it.
Hypocrisy. Interesting. Mm. So out of the plains of Kansas, they're really holding their own, really, amongst everyone else. And aggressive, I guess this instills a little bit more of a belief and responsibility to their beliefs, basically.
I always think like the story of the Kane family is really interesting, from Castletown. So old J.W. Kane, the father, he is born in 1808, and the family is sort of mill priests and Canes, and they head off to the U.S., and they arrive in Kansas. J.W. and his two sons, W.S., so William Kane and a John M. Kane, they arrive in Kansas in 1856.
Okay, but that's...
The
Laxey Church was built in Wisconsin in 1855. And on the gravestones, it's to say followers of Wesley.
Oh, I've seen that. Yeah, it's a beautiful little church, isn't it? Yeah, I've seen a picture.
So,
but these guys arrive in Kansas. Now, why would you choose to go to a place like Kansas?
Tornado Alley.
Yeah, and right in the middle of this Civil War situation, pre-Civil War situation. It's because Kansas, you know, there's a big argument at this time, is Kansas going to be a slave state or a free state? People with strong opinions are moving into the state from both sides to try and establish it as a northern or southern state. So you've got to have political motivation to go move there, and that's what they do. And that becomes apparent when the war breaks out, because both the boys, William and John, enlist for the Union Army. But they don't just enlist for any regiment. They enlist in colored regiments as ordinary soldiers.
And who would be in the colored regiment? I think it speaks for itself.
Yeah. So they would be, well, I would think in those days in Kansas, they'd mostly be escaped slaves.
And, of course, Native American Indians, I believe, were part of that regiment as well.
Right. Oh, I didn't know you'd been reading up. So we have these guys both saw active service and stayed in it right through the war, even after the Confederate side were saying that they weren't going to take white officers as prisoners and there'd be no prisoner exchange. I think that's something, that's quite an impressive thing, isn't it? These boys from Castletown. Join us from Castletown.
Somewhat, yes. Yeah. Because there's not much more of a desperate situation in life than warfare.
No.
But when the rule book goes out of the window as well as being involved with warfare, the rebels did not like facing these coloured regiments, did they?
No, and all through the war, these guys, these anti-slavery Manxmen from the North, are writing to the Herald newspaper. And it's almost like a weekly column of what's happening. And this J.W., the father, just before the war, I should have mentioned this, but just before the war broke out, he was standing for election as Justice of the Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that he lost a lot of votes because he was arguing about real equality. And one of his opponents said, "What if your daughter married a black man?" And he said, "If that's what she wanted, that would be fine." And he said that lost him a lot of votes. Now, this is the 1850s.
This is brave.
Yeah. It's good stuff, isn't it?
Somewhat, yeah.
It makes me quite proud because I think, you know, we... and I think there is that kind of human kind of treat people as they come kind of strain in Manx culture.
Indeed.
Mm.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Ireland Life, A New World, Old Ways with David Kinley. And I'm talking to Robert Tier about the Manx Methodist emigres to the United States.
In Cleveland and Ohio, there's some really strong Manx villages where they are all just speaking Manx. And Mr. Sheldon Carouche told several stories in 1863 at a meeting, and they were described as a somewhat clannish body of immigrants. It's probably the glue is this morals. it's probably the moralistic ingredient that's all binding all this together. And we've up to the sixth generation of Manx there. So, and that's in 1850s.
In the 1920s, there's a letter to one of the newspapers of the 1920s in Manx from a Manxman in Ohio, wondering how many people speak Manx now in the Isle of Man. And of course, there's a there are Manx lessons. And Manx speakers still in Ohio, and they've learned along with the revival. You know, they're not.
Yeah.
There's been generation gaps, but they're still there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it's really quite amazing from such a small island, which we are compared to the emigration figures off America during the 17 and 1800s that they have these villages where they're just still speaking Manx right the way up until the end of the 1800s.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, as I say, I think the glue is their moralistic and belief and what they've been through that civil war as well to last through there.
Yeah.
So to go back to the coloured regiments, Captain W.S. Kane has the 12th Coloured Regiment of Tennessee.
I think it's Kansas, isn't it?
Tennessee? He started in Kansas.
And he moved over to Tennessee.
That's the one he was posted to.
And his brother enlisted as a private in the 83rd Regiment of Coloured Infantry.
And there's not just these two brothers from Castletown. There's dozens and dozens of Manx descendants who are in the Coloured Regiments. And I saw a whole list of it, and it was just like, gosh...
Right.
This is a lot. This is a great belief in libertarianism and freedom and emancipation in particular.
Yeah. And I think it comes from this kind of, I mean, when you read through the Herald newspaper, the Manx people came from living in a dictatorship under the Athols, and they came through. And this is an interesting thing. So in the case of the Isle of Man, we have a very different history from the Highlands of Scotland or Ireland, because the British Parliament and the British Crown pushed through the changes in the Isle of Man to democratise things. It was, you know, I mean, with a lot of pressure from the Manx people too, but it was the radicals like Robert Bowring and people like that who raised the issue in Parliament. So we don't have the same sense of grievance, perhaps, as because, you know, we know that Highlands of Scotland and Ireland suffered terribly.
Plantation Act, etc.
Yeah.
Which is still, we're reeling from, really. That place never really recovered from the Plantation Act.
But there's a lot of positive things to be seen from the British government in the Isle of Man, in the 1850s onwards, you know.
That explains our more lenient sort of leanings compared to other Celtic countries.
Yeah.
Interesting. So one of the things that the Coloured Regiments, what their main role was in the bulk of the time, was serving behind enemy lines, so to speak.
Certainly away from the beginning of the war, just going to be used for,
railroads.
Services.
Yeah, and but boy, as we get into it, this war lasts 4 years. This is a long time to be at war, and but boy, they're called into task, and what a dreadful situation they're in.
Yeah, but
all these Manx white officers, shoulder to shoulder with their coloured regiments, and they're all in it together.
Yeah,
and they're fighting for freedom, liberalisation, and emancipation. Gosh.
We have to be careful not to, you know, they're not 21st century liberal humanists.
Yes, I agree.
But at the root of the thing, like they can see this is wrong. People should be treated equally.
Yeah.
And that's quite powerful.
Somebody touched on before a series of letters that were written from America about the abhorrence of the way the Afro-Americans have been treated.
Oh, yeah.
I believe there was a series of letters.
So this guy, Philip Crane, who was living in Rochester, New York, who also complained about the racism in America of his fellow congregants in the Methodist Church, who were, and he was complaining that people don't really treat them equally. You know, and he was writing and talking about the injustice of slavery regularly. And then a guy called Corkill from Ramsey, who was living in the States, he was writing too and talking about it. And the Kane boys, W.S. Kane, the older brother, he wrote about why he enlisted. And he talks about a slave woman being whipped to death, being left by the side of the river, and nobody was, or hung from a bridge or something, and nobody was allowed to touch the body because these pro-slavery people wanted to make a point in the town, in Aitchison. So, you know,
that's medieval.
Oh, it's
ways, epic, isn't it?
Yeah, I think if you saw something like that, you might even I might want to fight against that.
That's like London Bridge heads on spikes, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's truly awful.
Yeah. So the two boys signed up.
Yeah, I'd like to think that this this attitude of the Manx goes back a lot further. I'm probably exaggerating here, but
well, let's not pretend that we weren't involved in slavery too. You know, we were. I mean, there might not have been much choice in those days, but if we go back the century before,
yeah,
we were deeply involved in it.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
So maybe it was the Methodism that changed us. I don't know.
I'd like to think that the Manx are very kind-hearted even before Wesleyanism, because I just put this in here as 1617. That's a long time before Wesleyanism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Margaret Quain and a 10-year-old son are burned for witchcraft at the in Castletown Square. Yeah. And it caused such an uproar of the brutality and the abhorrence of what people witnessed that it was never done again
for witchcraft. Yeah.
Which, of course, carried on, particularly in the south-east of England and Scotland, for quite some time.
Yeah.
Well done to the people for being, you know, vocal about such a absolutely brutal act.
Yeah.
Which, and also the Manx were very, very superstitious, and they probably didn't think there was much wrong with it.
Well, there was another case. There was a couple. There was a poisoning incident in the 1830s. A couple from Sulby, I think. Well, it happened. I think the poisoning happened in Ramsey, and they were tried. And it says, and you know, it says quite clearly that they didn't really understand. They were Manx speakers, and the trial was all in English. And when it came to the hanging in those days happened in Castletown, but lots of the brewery said, we don't want the gallows built near our water source, and so it was difficult to find somewhere to actually hang them, because people didn't really like that kind of thing. You know, we're talking about the Athels. I mean, you know, the punishment under the Athels was for slander or criticism of the Athels.
No, I don't.
The pillory. But do you know what that involved?
Tell me.
So you're put in the stocks and your ears were nailed to the board.
My word.
And you'd be kept in there for, I don't know, several hours. And then when you were released, they cropped your ears.
Would this be 1600th, 17th century?
No, it was happening in the 18th century. Yeah.
Yeah. Good grief.
Yeah.
Gosh. Well, to go back to Captain W.S. Kane from Castletown, born in 1836, in the 1861-65 war, he is the captain of the 12th Coloured Regiment of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. I'm going off on a tenuous thing here. Looks sort of lighthearted, but as some of the tenuous links I've had over these shows, this one's quite strong, this one.
Okay.
But because it's Tennessee, and as our dedicated listeners would have learned in last week's show, that after emancipation from the Civil War, the Afro-Americans pretty much musically turned their back on the banjo, because it was symbolic of an oppressed past.
We've learned a lot about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what happened over the decades? Mm. Well, these guys, they took up the piano, and guitars, flutes, violins. And over the decades, what did they do with that? We had jazz, blues, rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a good founding here to Castletown could be twinned with Nashville, Tennessee, as the birthplace of rock and roll. I think it would be a great sign to have us here. Welcome to Ballacastle, twinned with Nashville, birthplace of rock and roll. Also, I do think it's such a strong moral story and a fascinating history that at least something like a plaque to dub down W.S. Kane next to the Wesleyan plaque to dedicate his life and his works to liberty, freedom, to emancipation.
Yeah.
I think it's a strong story which otherwise wouldn't be told. I'm a Castletown boy and I did not know about this.
We don't make enough of our own heroes, really, do we?
I couldn't agree more.
Mm.
Yeah, there's plenty of war heroes and stuff, but this guy's a proper war hero. Well, and the two, all the other officers.
The fact there's two brothers, you know? Yeah. Impressed me, and I thought it was a story worth telling.
So the Manx, the Methodists, would you say they were primitive Methodists predominantly?
Oh, no, I wouldn't know.
Right, yeah. But anyway, let's just call them Wesleyan Methodists have gone to the United States during the 18th and 19th century. Mm. And what they've contributed to that country was not their own selfish beliefs. It was a belief for all. Yeah. Which I think is a strong story from such a tiny island.
They've got such a... They've chosen to go right into that maelstrom for ideological reasons, for their faith. I'm impressed by it.
Yes, likewise. Gosh. Thank you.
Okay.
God admired.
And we will close today's episode with an American singer-songwriter born in New York City, whose father was a Native American Indian from the Blackfoot tribe and whose mother was of African Caribbean descent. This is Richie Havens at the Woodstock Festival, 104 years after emancipation, singing Freedom.
Freedom, freedom, freedom. Freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Along way from my home, yeah, yeah.
You've been listening to Ireland Life, a new world, old ways. You can listen back to this program by subscribing to Manx Radio Podcasts using your usual podcast provider. Gadamaid, Emu.